the headlines this hour. Iran's leader says the Islamic Republic is constantly engaged in challenges with world powers since it has disrupted equations of the hegemonic system. A much-anticipated report about the so-called Partygate scandal in the UK says the country's senior leadership must bear responsibility for this culture. And a UN official says that over 200 million people are facing acute hunger worldwide and attributes the crisis partly to the war in Ukraine. Warm welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that Iran has firmly stood against hostilities and enmities and continues to make progress. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with Iranian lawmakers. The leader said that Iran and world powers are engaged in constant challenges in various dimensions because the Islamic Republic's new model, which is the religious democracy, led to the disruption of the global hegemonic system. Ayatollah Khamenei also raised the alarm about the hostile stance of world powers and threats of those possessing atomic weapons against each other. He added that Europe is one of the most war-prone regions that witnesses increasing military provocations and war in its vicinity. Ayatollah Khamenei said such conditions, in addition to food shortages and an unprecedented spread of a disease, have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Political commentator Fuad Azadi believes the U.S. has seen substantial erosion in its hegemonic power because Iran has stood up to Washington's aggressive policies in the region.
So Iran has made sure that U.S. hegemony in Southwest Asia doesn't take root. Iran has been opposing U.S. aggressive policies in this part of the world. And that opposition that Iran has been engaging in has affected U.S. stance internationally, and it has contributed to the decline that we see in the United States. That has resulted in the fact that U.S. Has failed in its policies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, no matter where, in Iran, no matter where you look, the U.S. has failed. And that failure in this part of the world, I think, has resulted in people realizing that the U.S. is no longer a hegemonic power.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The British Prime Minister is in hot water again over COVID lockdown breaking parties. Long-awaited official report blames Boris Johnson and his government for the Partygate culture. The report by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant, says the leadership and top officials must bear responsibility for violating COVID rules. The report probed 16 such events held at Whitehall and Downing Street, while the country was placed under strict lockdown in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Moments after the report was published, Johnson, addressing Parliament, said he takes full responsibility for what had happened.
And I want to begin today by renewing my apology to the House, to the whole country, for the short lunchtime gathering on the 19th of June 2020 in the Cabinet Room, during which I stood at my place at the Cabinet table and for which I received a fixed penalty notice. And I also want to say, Mr. Speaker, above all, that I take full responsibility for everything that took place on my watch.
The Premier also said that he was humbled and learned his lesson, but he insisted he was surprised and disappointed over drink-fueled events. That is while new revelations show Johnson himself attended a booze-filled party at his office, adding to the calls for him to resign. The opposition Labour Party leader has lashed out at the Prime Minister. Keir Starmer says the report would stand as a monument to the, quote, hubris and arrogance of Johnson's government. He censured the government for flouting the COVID lockdown rules. Rob Carter is a correspondent joining us from London to give us the latest, and we also have Lembit Opik, former UK Member of Parliament, joining us from London also. Welcome to you both, Rob Carter. So, we've seen what the report's findings are, and we've seen the way Boris Johnson has reacted. Tell us about, or give us some highlights of that, and if you've had any chance to get some people's reactions on this.
Sure. Well, basically, Boris Johnson is in a very awkward position. There's no doubt about it. It's just the drip of these endless scandals really seem to be taking their toll now. Real pressure on the Prime Minister to basically resign as a result of these numerous parties, boozy parties that were conducted in Number 10, one of which, of course, was a birthday celebration. I think it was in June 2020. And this was a time when, obviously, the government was enforcing laws where the rest of us couldn't meet our friends and families, let alone do many other things. But of course, it seems as if it is very true that it's one rule for the rest of us and another totally for this government. So very, very difficult position that the Prime Minister finds himself in. And basically, after the recent presser that just ended just moments ago, where the Prime Minister took I think it was just a number of questions, maybe about 9 questions or so, before basically was refusing to, the point he was trying to make was that, look, he's apologized to the House and to the public, but ultimately he thinks that he could just be allowed to move on. And that's something which he hopes very much so will happen. But obviously his critics and the opposition are going to keep the spotlight on him and are going to pressure him, if not to resign, then to take some real meaningful measures to maybe hold some of his colleagues to account who were in attendance of those parties and some of which actually organized the boozy event.
Lepidopic, so what do you think should be done in this case in point? I mean, obviously he says this has all happened under my watch, so I'm the one responsible. But I don't believe, at least your opinion matters here, that suffice. So how should Boris Johnson, you think, proceed?
Well, all the rules have been broken by Boris Johnson. Other parties have signed up. That's the point that was made in Prime Minister's question today. He's the first Prime Minister to have been found guilty of a crime while he's been in office. So the normal rules don't seem to apply. What should happen is the following. First of all, the dog in the street knows that he knew there were parties. Let's not pretend. He can sue me if he wants to on that one, and let's see how far he gets. Secondly, there's massive resentment from millions of people around the country, including potentially me, because my mother died last July, and I only saw her at the end of her life. I didn't get to see her physically for a year and a half because of the very lockdown rules that Boris Johnson and his colleagues seem to have broken. I would say specifically, number one, there's still an inquiry to happen in Parliament, and it would be astounding if they accepted this, in my view, lame belief that Boris Johnson could stand with a glass in his hand, surrounded by bottles and people, and didn't realize it was a party. The second thing is, if people feel like it, they could go and they could appeal against the crimes that they've been accused of on the basis that if they broke lockdown, they can say, well, the Prime Minister did worse, and he looks like he did it more than once. So why should we have this on our records whenever it turns out that the Prime Minister had done much more than that and got away with it?
Twab Carter, sifting through some of the lines that Boris Johnson fed the public, whether it's in Parliament, not the public, but at Parliament and then in the presser, do you get the feeling that there may be somebody that's going to take the fall for him or somehow for him to be relieved of that guilty verdict that he's obviously so appropriately given to him?
Possibly. We'll have to wait and see how things develop. But one thing that Boris Johnson's administration is actually building a reputation for is not so much throwing people under the bus in order for them to get away with it, but it's actually protecting those who have been accused of corruption or sleaze or anything like that. So Boris Johnson is seen as kind of this overriding protector of corrupt individuals. And it's almost become like a the Tory party itself has just become a very stereotype of what critics of the Conservatives see them as, which is this kind of elitist club which treats themselves differently to the rest of the general public and has a kind of elitist mindset where they protect their own and not so much everyone else. That's basically what Boris Johnson has become known for, and it's quite possible that he will continue to do that. So we'll have to wait and see how things go. But one thing I want to make, one point I want to mention to our audience is that there is a real problem here, because not only is Boris Johnson's government heavily criticized and being condemned for all of these outrageous photos that are being leaked now. But actually, the opposition on the other side of the House also has its own problems in this regard. So Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, he also is being investigated for photos that were leaked of him, of himself also apparently attending parties which he shouldn't have been doing during the lockdown, where, there, again, there were boos present.
Well, then you can't have Limpidopic, a government that's run the way it has, and then you have the opposition that is also under investigation at this point, standing accused of the same. So what kind of political atmosphere are we looking at when it comes to the UK?
The situation is paralysis in this country, I have to tell you. I think that the point Robert made is absolutely right. First of all, Keir Starmer had about 8 chances in Prime Minister's questions to cause Boris Johnson to resign. He did such a pathetic job of it that Boris Johnson was still in post. But Tony Blair, would you like him or not, would have got rid of Boris Johnson in PMQs. Secondly, as Robert said, it's pot calling the kettle black. It's obvious that Keir Starmer is guilty of exactly the offence that he said was enough for the Prime Minister to resign. And that wasn't being found guilty of breaking the law, but simply being investigated by the police. And Keir Starmer is being investigated by the police. So he hasn't really got any moral credibility on this at all. Where do we go from here? Well, I think, as Robert implied, the public is just disgusted by this. Many people don't actually care. But those who have lost loved ones, those who maybe have lost work, those who followed the rules faithfully when it hurt them. And remember, my mother died in this time as well. Those people are saying, how dare you behave like this as Prime Minister? We expected more. And here's a fundamental problem. If you lie to Parliament, you're expected to resign from your ministerial position. That applies to the Prime Minister as well.
Very well. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Limpidopic there, former UK Member of Parliament. And Rob Carter, thank you. Correspondent from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. The UN official paints an extremely grim picture of the global food security, saying that over 200 million are facing acute hunger worldwide. Achim Steiner warns that soaring food prices could lead to civil unrest in many countries.
And this is obviously something that can quickly translate then into also political rupture. When people are not able to feed themselves, governments are not able to provide for food in the marketplace, then politics quickly moves onto the street. And this is something that is obviously of grave concern to many of us.
Steiner, who is administrator of the UN Development Program, made the remarks on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum's annual meeting at Davos. He attributed the current food insecurity partly to the war in Ukraine, saying that a large number of African and Arab countries heavily rely on wheat supplies from there. He added that the drought in East Africa will worsen the situation. Steiner also underlined that governments are becoming less and less capable of buying what he categorized as expensive food since the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic. According to the UN official, about 80 countries will likely be in debt distress this year. Russia says sanctions imposed on the country over its military operation in Ukraine should be immediately lifted in order to avert a global food crisis. The Deputy Foreign Minister Andrei Rudenko says a comprehensive approach is what is needed to resolve the food problems facing many countries. He called for the removal of the restrictions on Russian exports and financial transactions. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in February, the U.S. and its European allies have been spearheading punitive measures against Russia. Russia and Ukraine are the major producers of several staple crops, including wheat and corn. But sanctions, coupled with the ongoing conflict, have disrupted supplies of food commodities. U.S. President Joe Biden has traveled to East Asia, his first trip there since taking office last year. Taking a U-turn on decades-old policy, Biden said that he would defend Taiwan militarily if it was attacked by China. Now, that prompted harsh reactions from Beijing, but war threats reveal that the U.S. is in no mood of pursuing a diplomatic path when it comes to China.
The sour relations between China and the U.S. are back on the front burner. The U.S. President Joe Biden has angered China by his belligerent remarks over Chinese Taipei. Biden said that he would be willing to use force to militarily defend Chinese Taipei if Beijing invades the self-ruled island. Biden made the remarks in Japan's capital, Tokyo. He accused China of, quote, flirting with danger by flying so close to Chinese Taipei. He promised Washington would defend the island from any military action by its giant neighbor. The blunt remarks by Biden have been interpreted as raising tensions with China. Many past American presidents would have deflected, demurred, or declined to give a straight answer.
Well, in this case, the U.S. is trying to test the ground with China. It's trying to provoke and see the reaction. This is why you have first Joe Biden saying something, and then you have the White House saying the opposite. And they keep on doing that over and over. So they're trying to test the red light of China.
One possible reason could be that the U.S., under Biden, has abandoned its strategic ambiguity over Taiwan. The aim of that policy had been to ward off China from taking military action without the U.S. committing itself to a war. The White House official said Biden's comments did not reflect the policy shift. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the U.S. refused to recognize it as the rightful government in China. Instead, the U.S. had an embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to establish formal ties in a bid to create a counterbalance to the Soviet Union. And at the start of 1979, the U.S. gave formal diplomatic recognition to the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. In doing so, Washington recognized the PRC as the sole legal government of China. It also acknowledged Beijing's position that there is only one China and that Taipei is a part of it. After the U.S. cut off formal relations with Taipei, Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act. It has underpinned U.S. ties toward the island ever since.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has held a military parade to mark the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation. Hezbollah fighters paraded in Baalbek City in the country's eastern Bekaa Valley. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th each year. Hezbollah drove Israeli forces out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of occupation. Since then, the resistance group has grown into a powerful military force, dealing repeated blows to the Israeli military, including during a 33-day war in 2006. The Hezbollah leader, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, will deliver a speech on the occasion later in the day.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin in recent weeks. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Jenin Fiercely Resists Zionist Regime's Constant Attacks. Here's the story. A Palestinian teenager was killed by the Zionist regime troops in Jenin recently. Palestinian health authorities identified him as Amjad Walid al-Fayed, 17 years old. The Palestinian resistance group, Islamic Jihad, said their member was killed in an exchange of fire between Palestinian resistance fighters and the Zionist regime occupation forces during an Israeli invasion of the northern West Bank city. Hundreds of people turned out for al-Fayed's funeral. The Zionist regime occupation forces killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy during a military raid into the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. A second teen was seriously injured when the Zionist regime forces shot him in the stomach. Islamic Jihad said al-Fayed was related to two Palestinian resistance fighters who fought against the Zionist regime troops during their invasion of Jenin in April 2002. In April 2002, the Zionist regime's military massacred at least 52 Palestinians and injured scores of others in Jenin refugee camp, according to a report by the United Nations Secretary General at the time. The Zionist regime forces also shelled 150 buildings, leaving 450 families homeless. According to the report, 23 Zionist regime troops were dead by the end of the operation. Last week, the Zionist regime forces used a Palestinian teenage girl as a human shield during a firefight with Palestinian resistance fighters in Jenin. The Zionist regime's military besieged the house of Ahad Mohammad Reza Mereb in Jenin's Al-Hadaf neighborhood at 6 a.m. on May 13th in order to arrest her 20-year-old brother. After ordering Ahad's parents and younger brothers out of the house, the Zionist regime's army opened fire at the house where her brother remained. Her brother retaliated by shooting at Israeli regime troops, according to a field investigation by Defense for Children International Palestine. 2 hours later, Palestinian resistance troops began firing heavily at an Israeli regime military vehicle. The troops forced Ahed to stand outside the military vehicle for 2 hours while they sat inside exchanging fire with Palestinian resistance troops. Bullets were being fired at the military vehicle from all directions, Ahed told DCIP. I was trembling and crying and shouting to the troops to remove me because the bullets were passing over my head, Ahed added. But one of them ordered me in Arabic through a small window in the military vehicle, stay where you are and don't move. You are a terrorist. Stand in your place until you say goodbye to your brother. Ahad tried to tilt her head to the side to dodge the bullets, but one of the Israeli troops ordered her to stand up straight, DCIP stated. She was forced to remain there for 2 hours before running near a tree and collapsing. She was treated at the hospital for severe mental distress and low oxygen levels. After evacuating Ahad's house, where she lived with her extended family, including 8 children, the Zionist regime troops bombed the house with rocket-propelled grenades, causing it to catch fire, and then attacked it with live ammunition. In recent weeks, the Zionist regime military has intensified its attacks in Jenin, as resistance in its refugee camp has grown more defiant. The Zionist regime forces invaded Jenin refugee camp and the nearby town of Berkin on May 13th, as it has been doing on a nearly daily basis, wounding more than a dozen Palestinians and making arrests. One Israeli regime officer was killed in Berkin that day. The Zionist regime forces sought to arrest Palestinian Mahmoud al-Dubai. The Zionist regime troops surrounded his home and ordered him to surrender himself. Following an hours-long exchange of fire between al-Dubai and the Zionist regime occupation forces, which reportedly included Israeli forces firing Energa anti-tank rifle grenades at his house, al-Dubai was arrested. The amount of gunfire aimed at us was indescribable, thousands of bullets. An unnamed senior officer was quoted as saying by Arutz Sheva, a publication supporting Israeli regime settlement activities in the West Bank, adding, "I have been in the army for more than 20 years and I have never seen anything like that." In an effort to find new ways to thwart resistance, the fabricated regime of Israel is considering a return to the use of air raids against the camp, a method of repression the West Bank has not seen since the Second Intifada 2 decades ago. Helicopters and drones may be used to secure ground troops through the use of deterrent fire and possibly shoot at armed combatants, the Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz reported. Meanwhile, the brother of one of six Palestinians who last September escaped from one of the Zionist regime's most fortified prisons has died after being shot by the Zionist regime occupation forces in Jenin. During the fighting in Jenin on May 13th, the Zionist regime troops shot Daoud Zobeidi. He was a brother of Zakaria Zobeidi, the most well-known prisoner who escaped in September. Zakaria Zobeidi is a former commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, a Fatah-affiliated group. The wound was transferred to the Rambam Hospital in Haifa, where he died on May 15th. The far-right Israeli regime politician Itamar Ben-Gvir visited that hospital shortly before Dawood Zobeidi's death was announced. Ben-Gvir called for Dawood Zobeidi to be executed. The killing of Dawood Zobeidi brings to 228 the number of Palestinians who have died while in the Zionist regime detention. The fabricated regime of Israel is still withholding his body and refusing to hand it over to his family. The Palestinian Prisoners Club said the Zionist regime forces fired at him with the aim of liquidating him. The brother of another escaped prisoner died in fighting with the Zionist regime forces last month. Shams Kamamij, 29, was killed in Kafrdan village on April 14th when the Zionist regime forces opened fire at a crowd of people throwing stones at military vehicles. He was the brother of Ayham, another one of the escapees from Gilboa prison. The escape was viewed as a devastating blow to the reputation of the fabricated regime of Israel and its so-called security apparatus. The prisoners remained at large for days and in some cases weeks before being rearrested.
32.
Tuman.
Yani?
32. Bazaar.
The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more. Hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm Samson Seas, back from the Seven Seas. It's great to be back. This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole. So, let's check it out. Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items. It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company. But this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth.
As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here.
Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative, aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units. This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing stronger through serious local and international competition. Others argue that it's too soon to lift the ban, as more steps need to be taken to strengthen domestic infrastructure for manufacturing home appliances. Historically, universities were created to satisfy a thirst for knowledge. All over the world, rulers established knowledge academies for society to benefit from scholarly expertise generated in these institutions. And now, universities have an innate discovery. Their professors write leading research, and their scientific breakthroughs have revolutionized industries. Universities have contributed to health and medicine, which has sometimes literally stopped epidemics and saved lives.
With this in mind, and universities would make for excellent...
Welcome to another edition of Supports the Development. See why research is so important in the growth of industries. Stay with us as we uncover how the higher education system is contributing to the expansion of the national economy.
To get more insight on how universities support development of technology, we visited one in the capital city, Tehran. Islamic Azad University, Northern Tehran Unit, has been around for decades. Each year, some 40,000 students matriculate in bachelor's, master's and PhD programs. Academia shares the entrepreneurial drive for discovery and innovation. So, this university adopted a program for the development of technology and engineering, which is called the Roche Center. It is a growth center that manages and operates dozens of academic incubators. The program not only supports student innovation and entrepreneurship, but also provides services to knowledge-based companies for research and development. This platform receives support and oversight from the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology and the National Innovation Fund. The main goal in developing this program is to find technological solutions for various needs of the country. For example, the outcome of a research project conducted here was the formulation of a medicine used to treat COVID-19 infections. There are 40 core projects currently in incubation here, and the center has collaborations in many fields of the industry. It is able to stay present in innovative technology arenas by directly using academic research and potentials of its students.
Now, the advantage of growth programs, such as the one we just mentioned, is that it creates a network between students, research and knowledge-based firms. Most essentially, it joins the puzzle pieces of knowledge, tools and funds together needed for manufacturing innovative products. This helps create new and advanced products that might not exist in the market or need to be further developed for industries.
The center offers important facilities for scientific studies. It houses a large and highly equipped laboratory complex for advanced research. The lab provides services and equipment to 6 departments at the university, such as biochemistry and biology. The lab complex has many functions. One is to provide research facilities to students in master's and PhD programs in various sciences. Here, students who have graduated are also employed to conduct research brought in from outside knowledge-based companies. The other function of the lab is to provide a constructive link between university research and industries. For example, knowledge-based companies that produce pharmaceuticals can conduct their research and development at the highly equipped workshops. Research at this lab has helped companies produce many vital products that were previously imported. It might be interesting to know that researchers here adhere to strict national and international standards for product quality and safety. This is a critical step for startups or knowledge-based companies who want to commercialize products they have developed. This center was developed in response to the US sanctions. It has manufactured several products and advanced technology to satisfy the needs of Iranians during the period of sanctions. Some of these products are widely used in the medical sector.
Each university in the country has a growth program that supports the entrepreneurship and innovation of students and some businesses. These centers transform creativity and scientific research into products available in the market. In a nutshell, academic incubators are one of the tools used for economic growth. So, what is the government doing to strengthen research and expand the knowledge-based economy?
In 2016, Iran had 5 times more higher education centers than most developed countries in the world. At that time, there were some 2,640 higher education centers combined. By comparison, this number was just 40 units less than China, which is the most populous country in the world. That's all according to the Ministry of Science, Research and Technology. The ministry began implementing a nationwide plan to reorganize and aggregate higher education centers last year. Under this plan, small-scale academic establishments are aggregated into a network and operated under the auspices of major universities. This saves the country millions of dollars, and educational institutions are able to share financial and educational resources. This scheme carries many benefits. First, it helps academic institutions increase the quality of education and expand the reach of academic incubators. And second, it helps the government and higher education centers efficiently allocate funds and resources to develop focused programs for research. R&D funding is also an investment in regional innovation ecosystems that leads to advanced technology production needed in industries. There are around 3.5 million students in Iran, and increasing the number of graduates has an overall positive effect on high-tech employment in the long run.
Universities play an important role in determining a region's capacity for innovation and transforming new ideas into economic activity. They educate the local workforce, which creates human capital and produces intellectual property. Universities also indirectly contribute through their research activities, which other businesses can use to make commercial value. These foundational research activities help create and advance industries in many ways.
For example, the medical sector is one that has greatly benefited from advanced technology developed by universities and research-based firms. 56% of medical equipment available in the world market in 2018 had Iranian versions. That was based on figures from the National Medical Device Directorate. Some of these items were also on the US sanctions list. These products were developed domestically and produced along the lines of international standards, allowing them to compete in markets abroad. Another advantage of indigenizing advanced medical equipment was reducing costs and dependence on imports. Based on the National Medical Device Directorate, Iran currently exports its medical products to 54 countries across the world. In 2018, the domestic market for these items was estimated to be worth nearly $3 billion.
Okay, I believe it's time for me to take a break and pass the show over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field.
Hello, everyone. We are at Inatex International Innovation and Technology Exhibition. Why are we here? Well, this is a perfect place for different businesses and entrepreneurs to promote what they do and their businesses and to find investors. So let's dive in and find out more.
Focusing on science, technology and innovation ecosystems, the International Innovation and Technology Exhibition is the meeting point of businessmen, technologists, industrialists and researchers of different countries, held not only to introduce products and form partnerships, but also to provide various insights on the latest global competitive pricing, quality standards, developments, scientific findings and economic technological ideas. In addition to introducing state-of-the-art technologies to large and medium industries, this event tries to connect customers of technology products with their respective manufacturers and offer investment opportunities to investors of technology and startups.
Among all companies that are active here in this event, we have found one which has done an exemplary activity, and that is supporting smaller local businesses in their province, and that is Rafsanjan Sarchishme Copper Company. Some 400 companies are in this exhibition. Now, in addition to normal products that you can find out everywhere, they have got some sorts of applications. addition to their exhibition in this innovation park, they also have different events, like different companies and entrepreneurs can present and promote their products in order to show themselves and to attract investors. That's something amazing.
This exhibition has hosted the most significant players in the innovation and technology ecosystem over the years. This stage is not limited to a specific area of technology and innovation, but rather aims to increase the synergy of technology experts and entrepreneurs coming into contact. Therefore, the latest innovation and technology trends are reviewed at this event every year. Things such as metaverse, metadata, Internet of Things, physics, cloud computing, and blockchain.
Okay, I guess that's the end of today's show. Today, for the first time, I visited an exhibition like this, a place for different businesses, companies, and entrepreneurs to see one another and to find a way to cooperate. And that's the specific feature of this event. Thank you.
Many thanks for that awesome report. There is so much more that can be said about the home appliance industry and its related trades, so let's check out some news and trends in this sector. The country is keen to bolster and further develop the home appliance sector, so it has launched a new innovation centre that focuses on making products needed in this industry.
Some of the products being developed here include inverter compressors and other integrated products using artificial intelligence and electronics, among others. The centre also will use nanoscience knowledge to create a new range of smart and technological products. The goal is to complement the tech ecosystem by providing a space where knowledge-based companies and startups carry out concentrated activities. It is also meant to indigenize products for domestic needs and exports.
Iran's home appliance market is worth roughly $6 billion per year, but industry participants say 40% of this market is dominated by contraband. So, how has the government responded to this issue?
The government has carried out several schemes to combat this problem with heavier regulation. One step was to implement an ID program for all home appliances being sold. Another was the closure of over 300 websites offering smuggled goods. In June 2020, the first phase of the National Anti-Smuggling Plan was implemented. The Association of Industry of Household Appliances says such initiatives have reduced the number of smuggled goods to nearly $900 million. That's in contrast to the year before, when some $2 billion worth of trafficked goods were traded.
Well, that wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.